welcome to Coastless, the podcast dedicated to those living a connection-based travel lifestyle. I'm Melissa Yeager.
And I'm Boyce Richardson. Welcome to a new season of Coastless.
This week, on the
this week on the pod, we're welcoming Yael Abu-Halka and Becky Bosley to talk about their time with the Peace Corps in Namibia. But first, a little bit of a disclaimer about this season, which would ostensibly be season 3 of Coastless. We're probably going to be releasing episodes a little sporadically and potentially in batches this go around, purely because in the year 2020, Melissa Yeager and I are at least pretending to be adults with 9-to-5 jobs.
We both have jobs and we're both on different time zones, in case you didn't get the news that I'm living in Phoenix. So we tried to record some of these over Christmas. We've done one of the episodes in January. So we're just fitting them in where we can.
You know, and the reality is that everybody should be really happy that Melissa just survived her cruise on what I like to refer to as the broken down barnacle barge.
I think the Washington Post, they had a piece today that called it the ship of death, I guess is what the Italians refer to it. to give you an idea, I was on a cruise with the oldest cruise ship currently still sailing regularly on the ocean. There's another cruise ship that's slightly older, but it's not in regular use. And it's being used for a cruise from a Mexican port that's a driving distance from Phoenix. And it has an amazing history, the main part being, Boyce, do you want to do the review on that?
I really do. I was actually really excited about it when I talked to Melissa sort of generally, because she just made an offhand reference to a ship called the Andrea Doria. And for those of you that are within our generation, you may have the reference to this, you may not. But there was actually an episode of Seinfeld, I believe, during my research pre-episode. It's like season 8, episode 10-ish, about the Andrea Doria, where George Costanza has this incredible apartment. It's a two-bedroom, but he ends up losing out to a survivor of the Andrea Doria tragedy. And we later on learn that there were 50 casualties and about 1,600 survivors, and that it took the ship 10 hours to go down. And apparently this ship that Melissa was on was part of the Andrea Doria disaster, which just made my Seinfeld loving heart sore.
It literally is the ship that struck the Andrea Doria and divided it in two because it was an ice cutting ship. So it has an amazing history. I've written about it. I'll put a link on our website of it's been like attacked by pirates. It was owned by the East German government and used as a pleasure cruise for East German communist leaders who, by chance, some of them jumped overboard to defect. And so crazy history on this boat, but it is old. But the cruise was really the towns we visited in Mexico were amazing. A great chance to get a broader idea of the diversity of cities and towns in Mexico, and the people who welcomed us were awesome. So that was really great. So that's been also the problem with us trying to get time to do this this podcast, is I was on that cruise for a week and then came back sick. And so it's been an adventure.
Yeah. If I learned anything from Melissa's travels abroad on the cruise, it's that I have absolutely no intention of doing a cruise anytime soon. And I apologize to those of our listeners that are big cruise fanatics, but between the potential illness, the cold water showers, and some of the other accoutrements on the Andrea Doria destroying ship that Melissa was on, I think I'm good. I think I'm going to stay on speedboats or landside.
Can I say that's an important point? Because, you know, the people I talk with on the ship, some people loved it. They loved the charm of the ship. They loved the history of the ship. They were fine with some of the other stuff. The people who hated it, hated it. They wanted a more luxurious ship. So I think it's a great lesson of be realistic of what you want in a vacation, because if you are not, you will be disappointed.
Yeah, but I will say it's one of those situations where from an accoutrement standpoint for this particular cruise, I think the least or the lowest level expectation that I might have is that they would have an American plug-in in the room and that I wouldn't need a converter. I would not have survived the good ship Lollipop, I don't think.
You would definitely would have not, but you would have really enjoyed Santa Rosalia and Wymus. The towns had arranged some of their kids who are learning English at the university to guide everyone around. So that was really awesome because we got to talk with them, talk to them about what they loved about their city, which is one of the great things about travel, I think. So
definitely.
So beyond my cruise, beyond my 3-day tour or 6-day tour, as it should be, what's on your travel schedule this year, boys?
No cruises. it's very exciting to admit that on the podcast right now. As of right now, I have a 1-week journey to London for some Arsenal matches on the weekends, and then a midweek journey to Amsterdam and Groningen in the Netherlands for more soccer/football, some food, a visit to the Anne Frank Museum and the Van Gogh Museum. And then a little bit later, we have a wedding dictated trip to Mexico that is just over Labor Day weekend. But I think we're going to end up expanding out and try and go to some of the other areas in Mexico outside of CDMX, which Mexico City is just such an amazing place. We had really actually considered just doing the first half of the trip there, but decided it would be better to actually venture out into other areas of Mexico and experience them as well. We had just actually had friends that got back from a 3-city stop in Mexico that did not include Mexico City and did not include Cancun or Puerto Vallarta or any of the other places, just more sort of off the beaten path locations in Mexico. And they had an absolutely amazing time. So I think we're going to do a little bit of that. We might get into Belize a little bit and do some scuba. And then at the end of the year, we've allocated 2 weeks. And I'm honestly not really sure what we're going to do. My wife is actually headed with none other than Melissa Yeager to Peru.
You stole my surprise.
I did. I'm sorry. You can talk about it a little bit more. That's happening in April, but I think we might return to South America in November and spend a little bit of time in Uruguay or Brazil. We had actually looked at Uruguay last year when we ended up doing South Africa, and it had been really, really high on the list and just didn't end up besting South Africa, which was an incredible experience and will be the topic of another podcast that we'll be doing early on in this season. But I'm looking forward to it. It's actually strangely a little bit more of a low key year than in other years, but I have a strange feeling that a few things might pop up mid year that I'm not even yet aware of. What about you, Melissa? Where are you off to other than the place that I just disclosed?
Well, so Boyce's wife, Quinn, and I have talked for quite a while about wanting to do the hike to Machu Picchu. And so we finally booked it. And so we're going in April. And I'm excited for our girls trip. It's going to be, you know, girl power hiking. We're going to hike the Inco Trail. It's going to be a blast. Beyond that, I think I have a family trip in the works, and it is going to be another cruise.
All of that luggage. I just can't wait until the luggage comes back into play and your family members bring like 13 check bags. It's going to be great.
I did decide for this one that, I'm going to use our friends at Ascendus to help me plan this one. There's just too many moving parts. We have too many friends of the family wanting to go. It's a big year of celebration for us. So, I'm going to go stress free and let them help me out with that. So that'll be great.
And see, this is what happens when you join us on the pod. You get free plugs later on.
Our good friends of the pod over there. And then I think this year I've been thinking a lot about sustainability and whatnot. So I think a lot of my trips are going to be closer to home. I really would like to get up to Napa at some point, and there's a lot more I want to explore in Arizona. I'd like to go, explore the area, more toward the south, on the other side of Tucson, and then hopefully another trip up to Sedona, to do some more hiking up there. So, we'll see what the year holds. Fingers crossed.
I was going to say, I'd like to pretend to be put out in the fact that you guys planned this trip without me and that I wasn't included. But the stark reality is that I had already planned my trip before you guys planned yours. So I'm actually the one.
Well, how this came about is you have already been to Peru. And so
not that I wouldn't go back. So this is my thing. I will admit to all of our listeners that I am very bad about this, that I do not like to return to places despite my love for them. I would probably argue that Peru is like a top 2 or 3 country for me. and going back to see Machu Picchu again would be incredible. But I was on a mission to get to the number of countries that I am years of age. And Netherlands will be my 36th country before I then immediately turn 37 and the quest continues. Yeah, I finally got there for a couple days. All right. And with our trips and travels in the rearview mirror, we'll move on to Yael Abu-Halka and Becky Bosley, who were traveling exceedingly different than anything Melissa and I just referenced, perhaps even far beyond her broken down barnacle barge. And we'll have that interview next. This week on the pod, we are joined by Becky Bosley and Yael Abu-Halka, who recently returned from a 27-month Peace Corps assignment in Namibia in Southwest Africa. Becky and Yael, welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
First, welcome back to Kansas City. How are you adjusting to your return to the States?
We're getting along. As it turns out, I think we both agree that it's pretty easy to fall back into old habits of, you know, going to Costco, and I'm a big runner, so I just go out and run and do all those kind of things. But I'll also say that you occasionally, I actually just still have dreams about Africa. Like, oh my gosh, I just dreamed about my kids. And, you know, that just takes you back to some pleasant memories, for me at least.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we noticed, both of us noticed when we got back, was the pace is so much faster. And there's so many people, and we're all talking about our first world problems. You know, and you really have a perspective once you've been to Africa about what that means. And also, like, you go to the store, and my daughter just bought her first home, and she's getting a hammer. And so if you went to the store in Hobabis, where we lived, you'd have a choice of two hammers. We go to the Home Depot, and there's like 20 hammers. I'm going, which hammer are we supposed to buy? I mean, I'm you know, it was overwhelming. So the two main choices. Not always good.
No, I felt that way coming back from Germany. Going into the large grocery stores, I kept going to Trader Joe's and Aldi because they felt smaller and less choices. So I can only imagine after being in Namibia. I always think it's interesting. Some of my friends said it's interesting to see what people missed from America, like especially products and stuff. Were there any things beyond family and barbecue, of course, what you guys looked forward to coming back?
I'm kind of blanking out.
Well, what we did is, you fall back into things when you come here. But when we were in Namibia, we fell into what the pace was there. Our home was 500 square feet. Oh, that's what it was. We had a warm room for education stuff. We had a kitchen. We had our living room. And we had a little bedroom. Oh, we have to walk a mile to the grocery store. We walk a mile to the grocery store, you know, whatever. Oh, the store has what it has. And actually, Namibia, the stores in our town were pretty good. I mean, they had South African fruit. It's not like you were, you know, like a lot of our children lived in zinc shacks and no running water, no electricity. We had money and could buy stuff. So, but the choices weren't that great, but they were there. So you just, you didn't really, you know, it was like, oh, that's what we have. So we didn't really miss something. That's what we had available.
Well, one of the things, too, is as older volunteers, we weren't in the same position as the younger volunteers, so we could supplement our measly Peace Corps allowance. So our son's a police officer, and we wanted to be able to be in touch with him, you know, just because of the type of job he has. And so we made sure that we had internet. And now, a lot of the younger volunteers couldn't afford that, or they were in villages. We were lucky. We were in a town that where internet was fairly reliable. Not always, but fairly reliable. And some of these people were in villages and not reliable. They had to, like, maybe go 2 miles to an internet cafe so that they could communicate and stuff. So we could supplement our incomes because we're both pensioners.
As they call them. Pensioners. Yes, we are. Yes.
And so when the kids would talk about, oh, I can't wait till we get paid, you know, when they would talk on our
WhatsApp.
And we would just kind of look at each other like, oh, yeah, kids these days.
But I think that's an interesting way to segue in. Maybe we should go back to, like, you guys aren't the traditional, what you people might think of as Peace Corps volunteers. Why did you guys decide to do this and kind of give us the background story?
Well, you know, I grew up just a fairly normal childhood. But you know, you watch all these nature programs in Africa. You watch Tarzan when you're growing up. Well, you guys didn't, but I did. I'm old enough. These Tarzan movies, and you watch things about Africa. And I just got kind of a fascination with Africa. And I thought, well, I'm going to go to Africa one day. And then, of course, you know, President Kennedy and the Peace Corps, and that was kind of something I thought about as well. And I thought I would join the Peace Corps maybe when I got out of college, but then I did other things. I was so poor in college, I couldn't wait to get a job and make money. It's because I was so poor, you know, and I thought, why don't I go to Peace Corps? But I thought, I put it on the back shelf, and I thought, well, I will do this one day. And so when we both, when he retired and I retired before he did. And so we just, I said to Yael, I said, well, we don't have any grandchildren, because I know that's the one thing that will keep you from doing anything. So I said, let's go and do this adventure now while we... And so it takes about 9 months, though, of applying. You write essays, you get interviewed. The medical is very thorough. They want to make sure that if you have any kind of conditions, that they're well controlled. I have asthma. Oh, my gosh, they sent me through the ringer on that. So it takes like 9 months. It took 9 months before we were accepted.
But it was exciting. You know, we are older. I mean, Becky was the oldest in her group. We had 46 people in group 46 in Namibia. So Becky was 62 when she got there. The youngest was 20. He just graduated from college, age 20. So we had, you know, most of them were in their 20s. We had a couple, one was 36 and a couple were 31. But then, and then you hopped, to us at 62. But it was neat being around kids. I mean, we call them kids and that's what they are. But, most of them are real smart. Most of them care about other people. Most of them are there for the, I'm going to say, the right reasons, as Becky keeps saying. And she had talked to them. They've traveled everywhere. Speaking of traveling, they're big travelers. They really think about where they want to go.
Would they be millennials? Is that what they would be?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Anyway,
they are.
They were
Gen Z millennials.
They were the most, Gen Z millennial in that group. They were the most well-traveled group of people I'd ever met. I mean, you'd sit down and start talking to one, and it goes, oh, wait, you've been to the Philippines? Oh, I've never been to the Philippines. You've been to Indonesia? Yeah. Oh, you've been, all over. They've all traveled all over.
And we have two, but not a lot in younger, mostly with our kids and things like that. But it was good being around. My comment is, at our age, it's good being around young people because it keeps you younger.
Our perspective.
And they get our perspective. Even they didn't want to hear it. I'm the grumpy old man.
They get our eye rolling.
Like, yeah, our eye roll.
Okay, you got your safe space.
Yeah, you got your safe space.
So I told them, I said, when you go to work, the real world, there is no safe place. I just want to let you know that right now.
I like to refer, as somebody in their mid-30s, to our generation as the Oregon Trail generation.
We all
grew up in elementary school in rural Kansas playing Oregon Trail
all the
time. So it feels a lot less derisive than millennials is going to be over the course of time.
For the most part, they were great kids. I mean, really. Yeah. I mean.
And if they didn't, they didn't last in the Peace Corps. Actually, there were a few who washed out.
Were there people that didn't make it the entire 27 months?
I did a lot of research before we went, and one of the stats that's really interesting is that from the beginning of the Peace Corps, there's usually about a third of the group don't stay for 2 years. Like we had a few that made it a year. We had a few that made it 6 months. And for a variety of reasons, people get sick or people get, something happens at home. Somebody passes away. They go home. They don't come back.
Can't get along with their Peace Corps bosses.
They don't get along with their Peace Corps bosses, or they have a situation where something terrible happens to them in the Peace Corps and they want to go home. So
at the end of our term, 33%, almost 33% of our group had left. 14 had it. So 32 made it the full way, and 14 again. The only other couple, there's only one other couple, and they were in their mid to late 20s, and they were sent to this place where it was 115 degrees in summer and, yeah. and down south in Namibia. And as Becky said, I don't think we would have made it there either.
Yeah, I don't think.
So then they had a couple other reasons, but.
And you have to understand, I mean, there's no air conditioning. I mean, you could buy a unit if you could afford it. You could, but most people don't. And we didn't have air conditioning. It was very hot. In the summer, it's very hot. Their summers, our winters here would be their summer. And we had fans. And then it gets cold in the winter. Not real cold, but like it can get down to the 30s. And there's no, they just don't have any kind of HVAC system in their houses, you know.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but throughout the course of your 2 years in the Peace Corps, what was actually provided to you by the organization in terms of flights or lodging or stipends?
Oh, everything. I mean, they are very thorough. They, you know, they pay for your flight over. They pay for all your medical. Your insurance is covered for the entire 2 years. And then you can, 1 month after, and then you can purchase 2 months of insurance, 3 months. You get a stipend to live on.
About $250 a month. So not a lot. I mean, that's about.
And they find you a place to live.
How does that compare to like the cost of living there?
They say they want you to live the way the people there are living, and about $250 a month was pretty good. I mean, that would be about 3,000 Namibian. That wouldn't be bad.
Like for a janitor getting a job, we got paid better than
that. Oh, much better. The janitors,
the cleaners, they call them cleaners.
They got maybe 1,000 Namibian a month, which is, you know, $80 or something like that. I mean, it's just not...
80 US.
Not 80 US. But, so we got that. And as Becky said, we did supplement. But, and you also get about $375 a month for every month you make. So when you get out and you're... got to pay off your college loan, where you get about $7,000
to $8,000
to relocate the United States. But, and they also do training. I mean, the Peace Corps as a program, we found to be really good. Now, some others disagreed, but I mean, we did 8 or 9 weeks of training, about culture, about food, about all the stuff. And I will say we needed it. And I mean, everybody needed it because
you get language. We were terrible, by the way. We were assigned Afrikaans. See, Namibia has 17 languages, 17 plus sub-languages. It's unusual. It's an unusual country in Africa because it has so many. And so they try to assign you a language, and then you get tutors, and you're taught in small groups during this training period. And it's, you know... we didn't do so hot.
But we were there.
But can you survive?
Yeah. I mean, they're still here.
Yeah. You know the greetings. Yeah. You knew the greetings.
And they, a lot of people speak English. I mean, okay, here's the thing. You know, Americans were not very good with languages. Africans, oh my gosh, Namibians, most of them spoke at least 3 languages. Mm-hmm. And most of them were working on their English.
Well, they had to be because English is the official language, national language.
Right.
So, I mean, that's why we're there. I mean, it became the national language during their independence in 1990 because they did not want to do Afrikaans, which was the language of the oppressors from South Africa. So they chose English. Peace Corps was invited immediately to come there. And so, again, we're teaching English. Yeah. We taught English to grades. I did 6 and 7. We actually ended up having 4, 5, 6, and 7 at both. We had separate schools, but that's a good thing. And I would tell our kid, we both had rules in our class: use English,
right?
Because
and the other thing about the English is that because you're a country that's so polyglot, you have all these languages. You need a trade language because you're trading with countries that border you. You know, Angola, and so you need something that unifies you so you can do trade, and you know you. You can't, like, have Ochiarero be the trade language because the other countries don't know Ochiarero, you know. So English is it's always been a good business language.
Along those same lines, can you take us through your daily routine in Namibia for the 2 years that you were there?
Oh,
sure, yeah. The good thing is that after the training, so we had teaching for almost 2 years. And so we would basically... have classes from 7 a.m. to about 1:30. I taught in a tent for the first year, which because they didn't have enough classes. We had separate schools. The house we lived in was in a location. So the location's outside the town, and there were two major locations there. A location is where basically poorer people live. We lived in the Stryver area, where there actually were kind of homes and everything there. And that's where Becky's school was. We could walk to it and work on weekends. And then my school was in a poorer area where all the zinc shacks and all that stuff are. I had 1,000 kids, learners, and she had 500. So a typical day is we get up and we just, you know, have our breakfast. We have the lessons that we prepared the day before. Both of us thought one of the things that we could bring is actually be organized in class, because a lot of classes are not organized at either one of our schools. And just the way it is. So we want to be organized. And so we'd have all of our stuff and we're carrying things. I'd have a taxi take me to work, which taxis are cheap there. And we had a good taxi driver. So, you know, we'd have our classes. We did English and we did information communication, which a third of information communication is teaching them computers. Neither of us had any computers, so we didn't actually teach them about computers. We would bring in our laptops. We would bring in our boomboxes. We'd bring in stuff to help teach English and that kind of stuff. For both of us, although Becky's school was better, had some better students and all that, for both of us, we found the children, the learners, they're not really there to learn, because they know what their future is more than likely going to be in just 80-90% of it as a poor nation. They're going to be working somewhere. They're not going to be a doctor or nurse. Now, they have thoughts about it. That's great. But they would come to school because their friends were at school. And that's why they were there. That's why we had such horrible, in the first year, discipline problems. And so we tried all kinds of things, and we would come home and want to quit and come home. Every time I wanted to come home and quit, Beckett had a good day at school. Vice versa, when she came home, wanted to quit, I'd had a good day. So we talked each other out of quitting the first year. And the second year was much better. We each had about 200 students. And if you know their names, it's the same thing about all these teachers who follow me on Facebook. Learn their names. They will respond to that. And by the second year, we knew their names better. We knew what they would do. We knew some of the personalities. And we will talk about the libraries maybe at some point. But, I mean, that was the other thing that glued us together. But the classes were just, you just never knew what you were going to get. You know, they could just be running around in the tent and you're just like, oh, God, you guys. Or they'd be sitting there like, oh, no, they really wanted to listen this day. Like, oh, my gosh, they want to listen. I'm going to have a great lesson. Here we go. I'm teaching prepositions today.
Well, I would say I disagree with you. At my school, I think I had more students that were motivated.
Yeah.
It was a little bit more stable community, because it was the community that I was living in was just more stable and more parental involvement. Of course, there is the HIV/AIDS problem there, so a lot of kids are orphaned either by one or both parents, so they could be being raised by grandparents. We had that situation in our school and your school as well. And or they could be raised by an older brother or sister. So a lot of challenges, you know. And then there's a high rate of alcoholism, because the unemployment rate is 40%.
Wow.
You know, and you can make really cheap brew. We were warned against that. Don't drink it, because
it's like moonshine.
Yeah, so really, they have these shebeens in the communities. And so, you know, you had to go buy shebeens to go to school. And sometimes there'd be people out there like, you know, 12 o'clock in the afternoon drinking and drunk. And so, you know, it's a real challenge, you know, because when you have that high rate of unemployment, people are trying to figure out how to make a living. So they have all these kind of little entrepreneurial things they do, you know, selling things on the side of the road, or capana, which is a meat, selling barbecued meat at the side of the road. And, so they do try to come up with ways to support themselves, you know, but it's rough.
And how are the schools funded there? Are they mostly private schools, or is it government?
They're public. They are supported by the education ministry. At one time, I remember my principal saying that people did pay for school, but then they passed a law that said nobody would have to pay for school, because then there were so many kids that couldn't go to school. So Unfortunately, it's the education is not, you know, because the resources aren't there. So the education is they have a two-tiered system. The whites go to private school and they get a lot of things, you know, because it's tuition-based and they can pay for them and stuff. But it's still not. I mean, we visited one and it's still not.
Blue Valley.
Yeah, it's not Blue Valley. It's not anything. It's not Raytown. It's not Ruskin. It's not, you know, it's none of those. It's really bare bones. And, but, you know, they still produce doctors and nurses and people like that out of these communities, you know, so it's not impossible. It's just that there's just a lot of challenges. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess let's go back to the library, and because we saw your tweets asking that you were collecting for books. How did that come about? And tell me what that meant for the kids there.
Well, each Peace Corps volunteer is supposed to have like goal two. You know, your goal one is to teach. Your goal two is whatever else. My school, the library, had been closed for 3 years before I got there.
Wow!
Imagine, you know, an elementary school library closed. Now, when I went in there, it's like, well, it might as well have been closed because the books were crap. You know, they had 250 English books and most of them from the 70s and before.
Wow.
Some, you know, they had a lot of just junk books they put in the nonfiction section. So that was my library. And I thought, well, gosh, I've got to improve this. So the second part of the first year and then all of the second year was spent really making, at least in my school, the library as good as I could. And that's where I got permission from the Peace Corps to solicit books. And so people sent books over there, which is very expensive. So
we're very appreciative of that. Shout out to all you Kansas Cityans that sent us books, because it's expensive to send books overseas.
Did you bring books back with you as well?
Well, what happened is
we got
about 600 books sent to us. And then when we came back in December 18, which was right before our second year,
to visit,
we had the big program was one at the library. And like 325 people came, brought us 800 books.
Wow.
So we took 7 suitcases back with us. And then my son sent 3 more boxes of books. So, I mean, basically, I think the total number was 1,500 books total. I probably got 1,000 of them. Becky's library got about 500. Her library was better than mine, even though I had fewer kids.
My books, though, in the Afrikaans section, you could open up the front of the book, and it had the stamp. It had the stamp of the apartheid.
Oh wow!
From the 80s, the 70s,
apartheid
80s.
Schools. The schools were apartheid. You know, during the 19 what all the 70s, way up
80s,
to
yeah, yeah, yeah
up till independence almost, and they were apartheid.
But we both took, Becky did this. See, now Becky's a real librarian. I mean, she taught, you know, she was a librarian at it. So I took my cues from her. But we had prefects, library prefects, who here's the thing, they really wanted to do something, not to impress us, but just to have something to do. And so Becky trained library prefects. I trained more just because we had more we had more kids. But I mean, eventually, probably at 19 the first year and 30 the second year, and they would love to come in there and check out books and check them in, read them, and do all that kind of stuff. So that was you look back on, I just see these kids coming to the library. You know, the library was closed, and now they're checking out 50, 60, 100 books a day. Fifth grades 5, 6, and 7. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was good.
It was great.
It was probably the best part of our service, I think, was to provide better libraries.
That should be there.
Yeah. And there's no, there's 2 bookstores in Windhoek, which is the capital, 2 used bookstores. And we actually kind of went there quite often and bought books, you know, children's books, used books, and got to know one of the book owners there, the bookstore owner. And,
but other than that, there's not a book reading.
There's
culture.
Libraries, but you know, I mean, they're just like they're not open on the weekends, not open on a Saturday, not open. You know, they have strange hours, and they're not very accessible. Not open at night. So, yeah, it's just hard, you know, because I think the cultures are not, you know, that's not how their culture started. They didn't start with, you know, books and writing and all that. That's not really, and Namibia is, it's kind of Western culture meaning traditional culture. So, like, I took a picture one day of the donkey cart going down the street with the wood on the back, and they sell it to people that don't have kitchens, you know, or inside kitchens or electricity, and so they can build their cooking fires. And then right behind that was the car, you know. So they have it's a lot of Western culture meeting the traditional cultures, and so yeah.
You touched on this sort of generally, but I'm curious, what did you expect to take away from this experience in the beginning, and what did you actually end up taking away from the experience?
The greatest thing for me was I didn't really have expectations, because I get very rigid and type A and things. So my expectation was, I'm going along with my wife, we're going to do this training, we'll see where it goes. And the expectation was, I did not expect to be in a tent. So when I'm putting a tent, like, okay, I'm in a tent for the first year. Second year, I wasn't. I read all these books about how to get the kids to listen to you. Oh, that all went out the window. You could do all this stuff,
yeah,
but it's just not going to, it did not work as well as it could have. But the expectations change. I mean, really, by the second year, and we both ended up teaching a lot of art in her second year, so we brought a lot of art supplies back. And that turned out to be just amazing because, again, these learners really have nothing as far as, you know, like I gave them something to draw in. We brought crayons back. We brought Crayolas back. We brought markers back. All these kind of things that they could actually work with their hands in and make Valentines and make stuff. So I would never have expected to teach art, as maybe to answer your question. But in doing it, I'm not going to say I was a damn good art teacher, but I was very enthusiastic. They thought I was a good teacher, I think. But always have a lesson plan. Because you walk in there, and they're used to their teachers being on the phone, not having a lesson plan, and 8 times out of 10, not actually being in the class. And so I would never be on my phone. I'd always be in the class, always have a lesson plan. Same thing for Becky.
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, for the most part.
Did you ever imagine you would be doing it, like switching from journalism to this, switching from...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where else they would have put us. We don't have any really agricultural skills, except we plant a garden in our house, you know, and we don't have any engineering skills. These are the things that I couldn't think of any other area but the education. Now, I have kind of a medical background. I was an occupational therapist before I became a librarian. So I could have gone into the medical field, probably taught. And usually what they have you do is teaching the HIV/AIDS education programs. But I probably could have done that. But
I assume they're not on the lookout for lawyers.
You know, they'll use anybody.
There's a business section.
There's a business entrepreneur. Yeah. One of our good friends.
There you go.
One of our older friends that was in Hobabis. She worked in the entrepreneurial program. Her name was Susan, and she would go to these tiny little towns. One of the towns was called Dreamyopsis. Isn't that a wonderful name? Dreamyopsis is the town.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. And she would go to these little towns and work with what are the San people. And you have to understand, with these cultures and tribes, there's a pecking order. You know, there's a certain group at the top. The coloreds are at the top. And that's not a derogatory term in Namibia. I know it is here. Okay. Just want to make that clear. Anyway, for any listeners.
Yeah, it's probably good to.
Yeah, I want to clear that up because that is just what that is. It's a hundreds of many generations ago when the Dutch came and, you know, they intermarried or whatever, had mistresses with tribal groups, and that became the coloreds.
Is it almost like a caste system there?
Well, you know, they don't want to talk that way, but and they want to be one Namibia because they realize that that's the way forward. But when you get to know certain people of different groups, they may, you know, diss other groups like the Hereros will say, "Oh, those Nama people," you know, or but whatever. So it's humanity.
One of our host parents, we had two host parents. When you do some training, you go live with a host parent for a week or two, and we were with a host parent. And he was talking bad about one group, and then he said, "And the white people. Let me tell you about them." And then he looked over at us. "Oh yeah, they're white." Okay, so he stopped right there. Like, oh, and he was a great guy.
Never mind, scratch that.
But like Becky was talking.
It was great funny.
Becky was talking about the San people. The San people
are. Oh, but I meant to tell the rest of the story about Susan. But anyway, sorry. But anyway, the Sans. So she would go to these little towns, and one of them was Dreamopsis, and these San women were getting cheated because they never got to go to school and learn math. And so when they were doing their selling their wares, whether it be food or crafts or whatever, they could be easily cheated. Oh. And they didn't have any understanding of money. And so she went and she taught them, you know, just basic money skills, you know, like, and how to take care of your money and how to, you know, keep from being cheated and stuff. So she was very good at it.
And teach them how to win an argument. It's a very valuable life resource that I would provide in the Peace Corps. Yeah,
how to bargain.
Exactly. So generally we like to ask our guests for their respective packing strategies, but I'm pretty confident we've not yet had anybody on the pod who's packed for over 2 years at one time. Can you talk a little bit about the internal process that went on between the two of you in deciding what to actually bring with you?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that we brought that, you know, you never know what's going to become handy. And I got one of these bags that it's a nylon bag and it gets this big, but it squishes up to about this big, you know. So we use that thing every day.
Yeah.
We took it grocery shopping. I took it to the school. I used it all the time. And I never even thought about that I would use something like that. It was like my most valuable thing. And then people would go, "Where did you get that bag?" I want one of those bags. And I said, "I can't even get another one. I tried to get one at Target when I came home and they didn't have any more."
But
so,
ultimately, we brought too much. People do. They all get two suitcases and a carry-on. Yeah. And at the end of the day, like, I'm usually a light packer, so I think I did okay. I brought two pairs of shoes, dress shoes. I wore the first pair the first year. They wore out. I wore the second pair the second year. And by the time I left, they had worn out. I just threw them both away. My son brought me a couple of pair of running shoes. Both of them had worn out by the time I left them behind. I think we ended up with, you know, 4 or 5 shirts each. Becky had a little bit more clothes than I did.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's and the other thing is, in Namibia, we actually could get more stuff than we thought. You know, they'd said, "Make sure you bring batteries, blah, blah, blah." Well, no, we could have brought batteries there. We could have bought socks there and things like that. Now, you could not buy, as it turned out, really good sheets. We found that out.
I'll tell you what, everything was made of polyester. And if I had known that, I would have brought as much cotton clothing as I could because it's hot and you want something that breathes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the things was, I can't remember what I was going to say. That's okay. But anyway, I'll think of it.
But when you're packing, I think when we went home, it's kind of like we're just trying to get rid of stuff, obviously, but it's also, "No, we don't need to bring that back. Oh, we shouldn't have brought that. Why'd we do that?" I left, I left every one of my, I had a big parties at the end. I had 8 different class parties. So we have music and giveaways and all that. So I'm giving away my shirt. I gave away all the other, some other things that we had accumulated, art supplies.
We left a lot of stuff for him to use.
That was a lot of fun because we did not definitely want to bring it home.
I guess the final question for you, did you guys get to travel much and see much of the country and the continent about Africa?
We went to Botswana. We went to the Okavango Delta, which has always been one of my lifelong dreams, is to go there. We went there. It was just fabulous. And because of the dollar, you get so much more for your dollar there. I mean, you could stay in some really great places, and it's so much cheaper than it would be in the United States. And Botswana, and we went to
Victoria Falls,
and we went to
Kruger Park in South Africa. It's wonderful.
And I'm really into the animals, so everything we did was safari-oriented. And I said, you know, who knows if we'll ever get back here. Our plans are to go back someday, but, you know, you know how plans are. You never know if they're going to
work. We were just in Kruger, or a little bit outside of Kruger in November.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's.
How'd you like it?
It was amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah. It was life affirming.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those, it's a hidden asset of the Peace Corps is that, oh, you're in a place that's really far away. Oh, gosh, over 2 years, I think we took four different vacations to four different general areas. And our kids came with us to one of them.
Yeah.
And as we're going up to the park, seven giraffes come across the road. We're not even in the park yet, and seven, and they get out of the car and they're taking pictures. Yeah, you're not going to see that in the United States. Yeah. You're probably not going to see that. Probably didn't see it ever again, really.
Driving back from the Capitol in our with our taxi driver, he said, oh, there's a lot of animals on the road. We have to be really careful. And I'm thinking, yeah, if you hit a buffalo, a Cape buffalo, you're pretty much
90 miles
dead.
An hour.
He wins.
Yeah, the Cape buffalo wins every time.
Going really slow. But you could see them off the side of the road. And it was like, wow, scary. Yeah.
All right, one final question for the two of you. Now that we're only a few years away from a new terminal at MCI, individually, if you could pick one spot in the world to have a nonstop flight from Kansas City to anywhere, where would you pick?
Well, I was going to say Iceland, and I could have done it at one time. I was so sad to find out they stopped that, because that was a plan.
Australia, New Zealand, which I think we've actually both talked about doing at some point, just because we've had a couple friends go there.
I want to go to Thailand.
Yeah. Well, that's true, Thailand too.
But Iceland too. As soon as they reenact that, that'll be great.
Yeah. We'll have to hope that the Max 8 comes back and Iceland Air has their little planes again. However you feel about the Max 8, I guess. Becky and Yael, thanks so much for joining us. Yael can be found on Twitter at YaelTaboUhalkah. I got my spelling in for the day. Also, don't forget to follow us on Coastless on social media at